Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming. Just before we get started, I just want to, you know, give a shout out to our Thrive team. One of our members is here, who is also an IRB. His name is Bobby Sankey. If you stand up, let everybody know, see your pretty face. Is there anybody else? All right, yeah. Thank you, Bobby, for showing up. And he's also an important part of this, and his name, you know, deserves to be up here, too. So thank you very much. And so, as you see, we're no relationships to disclose. And unfortunately, I got to read these notes because, you know, kind of got here a little bit, you know, moved on it. So this is based on a Thrive study. It is the, as she said, using a health impact assessment to engage tribal leaders and inform the development of a healthy food retail intervention through the Thrive study. And the Thrive study is the Tribal Health and Resilience and Vulnerable Environment study. And it's NHLBI funded and through a randomized trial, CBPR orientation to implement healthy makeovers in tribally owned convenience stores in Chickasaw and Choctaw Nation, which are right there in the corner here. It's Choctaw on this side and Chickasaw on this side. So it makes up almost a quarter of Oklahoma, these two nations. And it's to increase the availability of intake of vegetables and fruits among tribal citizens. So basically what our long-term goals are to have a sustainable changes in healthy food availability and access in tribal nation communities, the implementation of health and all policies approach within both tribal nations. And so, you know, that to use the convenience stores to increase healthy snacks, meals, fruits, and vegetable consumptions among the tribal members. Our Thrive study aims are to, aim one, quantify the food environment and assess the correlation with prevalent obesity, diabetes, and hypertension in the Chickasaw and Choctaw Nations of Oklahoma, and aim two, to use participatory research methods to design, implement, and evaluate a multi-level convenience store-based intervention to increase the availability and intake of vegetables and fruits among our tribal members. And to show kind of what we're doing through a food environment conceptual method is that the thing we're going to be looking at is more of the policy variables of government and industry policies through the environmental variables, specifically focusing on the convenience stores and how the environmental variables affect both the individual variables and the behaviors of eating and physical activity patterns. But for the further of this, we're mostly going to be focused on policy and the convenience stores. And the tribal convenience stores are in the Choctaw Nation. There are several throughout the nation, but the ones that we're focusing on is this one in Broken Bow, Oklahoma. It's the Choctaw Travel Plaza and the Chickasaw Travel Plaza, which is in Ada, Oklahoma. And this is the interior of what the Choctaw Travel Plaza kind of looks like. As you see, there's fountain drinks and other kind of like slushy machines and all that kind of stuff. And over here is what they deem the hot box. But also, it's also like a place where you can order like lunch foods, but mostly they're like hamburgers and those kind of foods. And I guess this was taken during the Valentine's Day, as you see the little hearts down there, so how lovely. And then here's this, like the soda shelves, and as you can see, you know, a good stock of sodas, a stock of water, and then the flavored water, and then further on down, like the juices and like the flavored juices, which are basically sugar water too. And so this is kind of what the hot boxes are as we talk about hot boxes. And what it is like they're in these convenience stores and mostly fried foods made of like there's like burritos, poppers, and hot wings. And you can either buy these as individual foods or you can buy them as in a bulk in a little sack. And these are like very popular around this area, in case, I don't know if you people have these in your neighborhood. Some of it's pretty good. But and at the Chickasaw travel stop, we have the these are what their foods look like. As you see, there is already beginnings of saying things like stay busy, keep moving, stay fit, freshen up, change your world, and using these foods, some of which are actually healthy. And so, but as you can see, there's this little Coca-Cola snack thing right here on this wall, like I think it's like a pack of Coca-Cola and a sandwich. And so as we moved into looking at all these things, we realized that the gaps in our knowledge has summarized what we realized we didn't know. And the gaps in knowledge were our national and state obesity policies may not directly reach tribal citizens, Existing research has focused on state and national policies, has excluded tribes. The generalizability of evidence-based obesity policies in context with tribal settings is unclear, and 566 tribal nations are all unique and diverse in geographics and political infrastructure, and also in the way they do research. And tribals are uniquely positioned and inherently motivated to implement obesity policies given tribal citizens' healthcare costs. And researchers and health planners must be familiar with these tribal policy-making processes if they wish to intervene with tribes. And tribal leaders must be equipped with health impact and cost-effectiveness tools to make informed decisions. And tribal economic sovereignty must be incorporated in obesity policy-making. And these gaps are the reasons why we chose the health impact assessment. And I'm going to have Jordan here to talk about that and our findings and all the things that we've done through that.
Okay, so this is just the National Research Council of the National Academics definition of an HIA. The reason we chose to incorporate an HIA was to equip tribal leaders with knowledge for policy planning. And so here are the steps in an HIA, six or seven: screening, scoping, assessment, recommendations, reporting, monitoring, and evaluation. We are still technically in the assessment phase because we are still collecting data. We also recently completed, last spring actually, an HIA training with the Human Impact Partners. They conducted the training in the Chickasaw Nation for us. We had members of both Chickasaw and Choctaw government. We had government, nutrition, commerce. We had, I think, approximately 30 members of between both teams. So that was actually quite beneficial to actually most of us that maybe don't always work in public health don't necessarily know what an HIA is, just to hear it. So that was really good for people like our managers of our travel stops, in higher government, to hear what an HIA is and how it's important. Okay, going back to our aims, the aim one, like Tully said, was to quantify the food and physical activity environments and assess the correlation with prevalent obesity, diabetes, and hypertension. So to complete this, we did a quantitative survey with a total of 513 people in the Chickasaw and Choctaw Nations. We did this with iPad kiosks located in community and clinic-based settings. So our tribal partners sat in our tribal clinics or in other community areas with iPads, and it was a Qualtrics-based survey that people just punched in at right there. We got perceived and objective measures of health, food, and physical activity, sociodemographics, and health behaviors and outcomes. Here is a table of some of the socio-demographic characteristics we got. I know that's a lot to look at, so I will just say that over half of our tribal members surveyed were obese or had a BMI of greater than or equal to 30. 29% were overweight, 49% were told by a health professional that they had high blood pressure, 24% reported a diagnosis of diabetes, 75% reported eating fewer than 3 servings of vegetables a day, and 56% reported fewer than 2 servings of fruit a day. Some other things we looked at in relation to food insecurity were how far people had to travel to find groceries and whether or not they developed a monthly food budget. Over half of the people lived more than 20 miles round trip from a grocery store. We also asked them the frequency of places they shop, and so you can see, and it's actually third, so it's the middle, the convenience stores. 65% said that they shop for food at the convenience store at least once a week, so the travel plazas or travel stops. And from our focus groups, I can say that people actually said it would be closer to once a day, maybe even more, so almost breakfast, lunch, and dinner sometimes at these travel stops or travel plazas. Here are some other questions we asked. So questions like, it's easy to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables in my town, there's a large selection, the fruits and vegetables in my town are of high quality, they're expensive, and my town, the cost has kept me from buying them. So many, about 36%, felt that vegetables and fruits available in their nearest store were too expensive and that cost prevented purchase. That was an overarching theme, everything that to eat healthy means to pay a lot more money, which is not always easy when you're on a budget. We also asked these questions about food insecurity. During the past 12 months, how often is this true? The food that we bought just didn't last, or we couldn't afford to eat healthy meals, and over half of the participants were food insecure. 56% reported that during the past 12 months that their food didn't last, and another 61% reported that they couldn't afford to eat healthy meals. Another method of data collection we did was the NIMS survey, so our objective food environment measures. We adapted and localized NIMS, which is Nutrition Environmental Measure Survey, and it was adapted by our dietitian on our team, Dr. Marion Wetherill, both NIMS-S, which was stores, and NIMS-R. And we had to adapt it because the NIMS mostly has been done in urban settings, and so it was more used in like corner stores or bodegas. So for an actual tribal convenience store, it was a little bit different, so we had to switch it up a little bit. Basically, just an overview of what NIMS is you go through the store and calculate basically everything that's in the store. So we're very thankful for our tribal partners for doing that. They weren't super thrilled, but they knew that we were getting good data, and they were very happy about that. So our second aim, again, was to use participatory research methods to design, implement, and evaluate a multi-level convenience store-based intervention to increase the availability and intake of vegetables and fruits among tribal members. So we did a total of 12 focus groups with 100 people. We're also doing video voice, qualitative, and environmental footage, the health impact assessment data, so the fruit store procurement cost, healthcare and utilization cost, I'm sorry, healthcare utilization cost, and then our NIMS, the Nutrition Environments Measure Survey. So we did a total of 12 focus groups. Like I said, 7 focus groups in the Chickasaw Nation and 5 in the Choctaw Nation with 8 to 10 individuals per groups. Tully and I personally sat in on all 12 of them. They were very entertaining. Tribal members reported that they were more likely to try healthy foods that were priced at the same or lower prices than non-healthy foods that were sold in tribal stores where revenue supported the tribal economy, and they were tribally sourced and or endorsed with tribal logos. So the specific intervention strategies that we've identified are increased availability, variety, and convenience. When we say that, we're talking about fruit and vegetable quick packs. A lot of people in our focus groups mentioned like Lunchables, so just quick packs of healthy meals and snacks, or even combo meals were something that was really bragged on by the people who frequented the stores. Labeling, so food labeling, labeling shelves and coolers with the Chickasaw travel CTS sign, Chickasaw Travel Stop, or the Choctaw sign. Placement, so large open air coolers were purchased in one location and will be purchased in the other, and they will be in the front of entrances. And the hot boxes will be removed to behind the registers, so less line of sight when you first walk in. And then promotional signage, one tribe already has a sign that says fresh food destination, which is placed above the coolers, and it's gone through their marketing department where they've decided that green and blue are more likely to. I'm learning a lot about marketing, everyone should know. Never knew I would need that. So the early pilot findings from one of our tribes that has actually already put the cold boxes in, or the coolers into the stores, all selected snacks and meal items sold out midweek during all 4 weeks. Store sales receipts track changes in pre and post sales for any items, so the fruit cups and some sandwiches that had been stolen in stores prior to the intervention but had been located separately in different and less prominent locations. They weren't tribally endorsed and they were sold at their regular prices. And among these items, the store saw an overall 71% increase in sales pre and post the intervention. And we're now in the process of scaling up these strategies for a larger intervention trial set to begin in January of next year. So our summary recommendations are to use participatory approaches that respect tribal sovereignty, including economic sovereignty. Fund studies with rigorous designs that incorporate HIAs and cost effectiveness analyses to equip tribal leaders with the information they need to inform policy. Build research and implementation capacity of tribes and research partnerships, and translate implementation knowledge of practitioners and disseminate the findings. And so we would also like to acknowledge, like we said, the Chickasaw Nation and the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma.
We have plenty of time for questions. Yes?
Studies that have found basically that So our independent impacts of looking at disadvantaged neighborhoods by looking at neighborhood level factors as well as individual level factors. So I was just wondering if you have considered or would consider any multi-level modeling that would take into account both the neighborhood level factors as well as individual factors to look at.
Interesting suggestion. because of our limited data, we at this point don't have individual level factor. We can get down to publicly available data, so we can get down to zip code level. Yes, our survey, because it's anonymous survey, so we don't know. I mean, we can tell at the zip code level where our residents live. One approach that we have been doing is actually conducting focus groups in these neighborhoods, and we will focus some of these zip codes. And so hopefully that will give us an insight at the individual level in terms of some of the barriers that these folks living in these zip codes have to face to come with that. And then hopefully we can triangulate these two data sets, both at some focus group individual level and zip code neighborhood level, and see the, you know, some findings there.
It's for the last group in terms of the actual Chickasaw study. You mentioned the IPAD quantitative survey that you actually did two questions. One, I think your results were 513, and I wanted to know out of how many, and then what was the motivator or incentive that you used to actually complete them?
Okay, I think I might have misunderstood the first question. We had a total of 513 for both tribes, so it was about 259 and 250, about 250 plus or minus 13 for both tribes.
Was it a convenience sample?
It was. Yeah, it was a convenience sample in the, it was targeted convenience in tribal clinics. The screening requirements were that they had to be self-identified as a Native American, live within the jurisdictional boundaries of the Chickasaw or Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma, and be between 18 and 65 years old. And we did it in community centers, the tribal clinics, and things like that. And the incentives were at the end of the gift card, at the end of the iPad kiosk, they had to fill out their address, and we then mailed them a preloaded $20 Walmart gift card. These are really good questions for Dr. Jernigan, if only she didn't have the flu. But no, I know one of the intervention strategies we talked about was subsidizing lower class foods. About, I think, a 30% subsidy is what we found in focus groups, that lowering at 30% is what really dropped, or what really caused people to want to buy incentivized. And so no, it would not be sustainable except for through the intervention. The grant does provide the funding, so it's at no cost to the travel plazas or the travel stops to lower that cost. But I do believe for the tribe that actually has gone ahead and put in the cooler box just to see some interventions, that it actually was at the tribal manager's discretion. So he's in charge of all of the travel plazas in the nation, and he actually did, I think, drop the price just kind of experimentally for himself. I will say that both tribes, commerce, leadership, management, have all been very supportive and very excited about this, so they are like very on board in regards to helping us do whatever we can. And in fact, Bobby Sankey, you might know more than I do about that.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so these all kind of sort of testing the waters and drop the price. And I think that our commerce brothers, know, we'll have the final results, you know, in our leadership. There's a kind of argument that, yeah, you still have to go up and increase volume if you go up front. That's very possible with those discussions. Just have to make a case about it.
Right. And that has been the tribe's, like, incentive, is that they do want to offer these healthy servings. So there is the possibility that these can stay at these convenient prices. But it's just, again, like, based on what our assessments and all our data shows and what they, those up there tell us what to do.
Yeah, it's
not a fair but leaders.
And it's important.
No.
It's important to note that, you know, as tribal entities, they're not working like a Quick Trip or an Easy Mart where they're working on a profit. All the money that they're making is going back into the tribe. So you can see why there might be more incentive in, like, lowering the price on the healthy food, because ultimately what they're trying to do is, you know, sustain their tribe.
No, I was going to piggyback on, you know, some of the things in terms of, I think you mentioned health is in all policy. So at the end of the day, you know, when you get this result, what predictive policies do you actually think would be changed and sustained over time?
Another good question for Dr. Jernigan, right? She's very into policy work. I'm not actually sure what policies. I'm still working on my doctoral degree, so I'm not sure about all the policies, but I do know that is the ultimate goal, is to do policy change. She's very interested in that, and luckily, like I said, both tribal leadership, very high ranking tribal leadership members are really interested in changing policies. What they are right now, I don't know specifically, and I'm not even sure that we have really conceptualized that this early in the study.
So do you know, in your doctoral experience, felt a little bad, because I think that's wonderful. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
But from your knowledge or from your exposure to the study, do you think that the key leaders or stakeholders have been engaged in order to actually now say, okay, here's the result, and now let's talk a little bit about the actual interdisciplinary approach to changing policies throughout the nation?
Yeah, from what we've done, like I mentioned our three-day HIA training that we did, we had people not just from, like, nutrition services, we had the tribal leaders, very high-ranking members of the tribal leadership, I can't, and they were all very excited. Like I just said, we the Chickasaw and Choctaw Nations are, I mean, their governments and their businesses, it's very unique, but ultimately they are, all their funding, all the money they take in goes right back out to the tribe. So I think, yes, they're... Ultimately, they want to see their tribe succeed, and not just that, the areas that they live in. So the Chickasaw Nation seat is in Ada, right? Ada, Oklahoma, Choctaws, and Durant. So they want to see not only their tribes, you know, succeed and thrive, but also the greater community. So they're definitely very interested in policy in all, you know, areas, cross-generational or cross-translational policy, yes.
And to add on to that, I think also is, like, when we came into the study, there were already movements going towards getting these healthy foods out into the tribes and to the people. So there is that incentive that is already rolling, and this is hopefully helping push that to make it a bigger snowball, yeah, to make it more.
So just on the prior comment, does that result, you not only move the food and you lower the price simultaneously, right? Mm-hmm. So product placement and marketing changes, right? So might it be interesting to do that in two steps, right? And if you have I guess you only work with two stores, so I don't know if it would work, but maybe just try to mark the placement curve. But you don't know really how much you really need to load, right? To get the right consumption level that you want, I think it should take you a little bit more study. And then I also was wondering on the purchasing, I think individuals coming in from community purchasing strictly with cash, or do they have
I know at least in the Chickasaw Nation they don't accept EBT or food stamps. I don't think they do in the Choctaw Nation either.
It's mostly
cash, yes.
But the other thing is tribal members with their tribal card do get like a percentage off on things in the store. So I think it's like a 10% at least in one tribe. Do you know, is that how it is? Okay. Yeah.
I think it's only gas that Chickasaws.
Yeah. I have a question for all the presenters, and that is whether there were any social workers involved in any of the work projects coming from public health services.
I can say that my minor, I'm the lowest on the totem pole. My minor is social work, and our registered dietitian, Marianne Wetherill, Dr. Wetherill, is when she did her PhD in public health, she also did it with a focus in public health social work.
Our study are not immediately known, but in our partners, we have partners and the Department of Health partners, we did our survey in SUSDs and in clinics and in also community-based organizations, so we have a mixture of social workers in those funds.
We did not. We had urban planners, which were in sort of a disciplined part, but we do have social workers who are, the school social workers, a partner member of the Detroit Urban Research Center, so they were informed and the board was involved in the sort of planning.
Other questions? I have a question for the Detroit group. So what happened next, though, when you do the health impact assessment? And then to what degree do you kind of anticipate there'll be a response to that? So, you know, in all of these, you know, in all of the health impact assessment approaches, I guess there's always a question of what's going to happen on the other side, how much of the policy
question. And Detroit is kind of in a unique place right now, so a lot of decisions are really diffused between public, private, and philanthropic entities that are making a lot of the decisions. So, like, it was private foundations that funded the Detroit Future City Study and are funding some of the implementation pieces. So our challenge is going to be to get these recommendations in front of all of those folks, as well as getting it in front of community members, so there's community mobilization at the same time, so we can push back on those systems to get them to listen. Although there was community voice in the development of this future plan, supposedly, the plan was already developed by engineers and urban planners by the time they brought it to the community, so it was really difficult for them to make any changes afterwards. They had already set their mind what they wanted to do, so even after the community forum, we saw very little change in what they had developed and designed.
So just one thing I would add is that it's very challenging when your civic responsibility, your governance responsibility is diffused across these three levels and is not necessarily accountable to election. So for example, the Detroit Blight Authority was established and it is run by Dan Gilbert, who is the founder of
Quicken Loans.
And so he is charged with the plan for demolitions in Detroit and how to use the demolition money. And then he is investing and purchasing those properties and housing his companies and his employees in the city. And he said recently,
He had said in a public forum that there was, Detroit presented a very unique opportunities for developers because they can come in for the first time in the history of urban centers and have cleared land with an intact infrastructure that they can get very cheap to build on. But he's also in charge of making decisions about what gets torn down and where.
So one impact of the HIA is that his key staff who was responsible for developing this flight plan went to several of our HIA presentations during the process and then approached the community partner and said, you know, would you come and talk with our team? Because, you know, all these developers are coming with us wanting to purchase the property that's just been demolished. And we really don't know how to dispose of it. You know, who gets it, who wants? Should we set some criteria for ongoing? Oh, I can't believe that I'm hearing this. And so we're thinking maybe you could help us develop a checklist or guidelines for healthy development or sustainable development of neighborhoods. And so, of course, I was delighted, but they're really thinking about the sort of hipsters and artist class and their employees coming in and literally buying and clearing blocks worth of land and then building new sort of mini cities in there.
Yeah, so in the city that 97% of people of color, that is in a hyper segregated metropolitan area, one of the most segregated metropolitan areas in the country, the fear of all of those of us who have lived there all our lives is that there will no longer be a place for people of color and poor people, in particular in the city of Detroit, who won't be able to afford to live in our own city.
There comes this one in the Bronx, New York, and the way they're building these communities is that people have been residents there their whole lives, won't be forced out, aren't kicked out, the city can't be built with that intent. So there are different, and they don't know a lot about this, they just know someone who lives from that community, why they partner up.
Yeah, and we have recommended a number of those policies that have been used in other areas. One of the problems is that in our state of Michigan, the Republican legislature and governor and the Supreme Court have now, as soon as something comes up, like an ordinance in Detroit to require community benefits agreements with the community when a large development project comes in, those have been preempted by statewide legislation that says that locales do not have the authority to establish agreements, community benefits agreements, because the interest is inherently in the state.
So and that's sure actually happening all over the country. Sounds like the city planners have learned the same thing, because when Detroit was Detroit, you know, it was just, they didn't, you know, people, white, essentially, moved out, and then everything shifted. So it sounds like you haven't learned anything from their history.
Well, and it's not just the city planners, it's, again, it's the whole metropolitan area and the state. State policies are very much race-based. Because Detroit is predominantly people of color, predominantly African-American, and the rest of the state's predominantly white, most of those decisions made in the state capitol and the legislators are based on racial ideas and inequities. So it just reinforces that whole segregation piece.
But if you go away from here with nothing else, remember, there's 700,000 people in Detroit. So don't look at the front of Time magazine and say, Detroit is empty, or let's reinvent Detroit. Oh no, we're reinventing Detroit is there.
Any other questions? All right, just as a reminder, this session was organized by Community Health Planning and Policy Development. And I'd like to thank you for your attention and participation. And lastly, ask you to join me in thanking the wonderful presenters this afternoon.